welcome, Red Eyes members. Thank you very much for joining us. It's good to have you here. We are talking with Robert Bovall about the Star People, or the Nabta Playa people, and the roots of Egyptian civilization and possibly even all human civilization. We've talked quite a little bit about some of the art, some of the carvings. Robert mentioned, for instance, that they've found pharaonic scripture writing as well in this region that we're talking about. And one thing that I've been pondering upon as you talk about this, Robert, is if there's any architectural similarities or evidence as well. Because again, I think the some of the early pyramid structures is just incredible how that sprang up in Egypt, so to speak. But what about architecture? Is there any kind of buildings or things that you guys have discovered in regards to where the roots of the architecture comes from?
Yeah, I'm surprised you're mentioning this, because indeed this topic has been brought up several times. Now, architecture in general is well recognized to have its roots in natural features, caves and trees and all these natural features have inspired primitive architects, if you like, to design their artificial buildings. That's why in Egypt, for example, you will find that columns are in the shape of lotus or palm trees or such things.
Yes.
Like in Greek, the Doric temples exhibit features that can be traced back to nature. So that's nothing unusual. However, one of the strangest of things is that it is in the third dynasty that architecture is supposed to have been born, literally not just in Egypt, but for the whole world. The oldest architectural complex built of hewn stone rather than piling blocks, if you like, cut stone, is the Saqqara necropolis. It springs literally without any precedent. The architect, we even know the name of the architect. He was named Imhotep, who was the vizier of King Zoser of the third dynasty. And we date this approximately to about 2650 BC. Now, one of the centerpieces of this architecture is a step pyramid.
Yes.
It's a step pyramid with 6 tiers. It's about 60 meters long. I will quickly move to Giza. Giza follows the third dynasty, and here we have the giant pyramids of Giza, the so-called true pyramids. But those who have visited Giza, and for the benefit of those who haven't visited Giza, let me say that the pyramids and the Sphinx are not the only monuments that are on this site.
Sure.
There are there's a lot of so-called mastaba tombs. They belong to nobles. They're in the shape of, they resemble sort of military modern bunkers, if you like, sort of big squatty tombs. There's a lot of these. However, the main monuments that also accompany the pyramids and the Sphinx are massive temples, three of which are at the foot of each of the pyramids. So there's three pyramids, three massive temples. They call them the mortuary temples. And then these are linked up with a causeway that goes down to the valley. And at the bottom of the causeway are the so-called valley temples. And now, only two of these still exist. They're in very, very bad shape. I'm not being very truthful here. There is in fact two temples near the Sphinx. There's the so-called Sphinx Temple in front of the Sphinx, and then there is the Valley Temple of Khafra. Now let me get very quickly to that. These valley temples are built not with the same type of construction that you see of the pyramid builders. The pyramid builders used big stones, but the pyramid blocks are on average about 2 to 5 tons. The largest of blocks go up to 20 tons. Mm-hmm. Whereas the temples, the valley temples and the mortuary temples that I'm talking about, use blocks of an average of 50 tons, and some of them go up to 200 tons. Hmm. Totally different kind of people here.
Indeed.
You know, we began to talk about a megalithic phase, a large stone phase at Giza.
Yeah.
Now, nobody's been able to explain why they would use these 100-ton blocks. I mean, it doesn't make sense. You know, there's no need to use 100-ton blocks to build a temple. I've always queried this in all of my books, but never was there a logical answer. It seemed to have been more of a religious idea rather than a practical one. I mean, practically, it's just impractical to use those kind of stones. It's a little bit like, I always give this metaphor because it kind of hits the idea very well. It's a bit like it's raining outside and you need to take your umbrella. But instead of just taking the umbrella, you take your whole cupboard with you. It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
All right, that's the same thing here. I mean, you want to build a temple, you can build it with, even with 2-ton blocks, which are big enough. I mean, they're really big blocks. 2 tons is quite heavy blocks.
Yeah.
But you don't need to use 100-ton blocks. It's just mad. I mean, 100-ton blocks is... Well,
why do they do it? Is it to show off, or is there actually a purpose? What do you think, it's a religious or
I very much believe it's a religious one, but...
Yes.
If they are, and not only they're large blocks, but they appear to be much older than the pyramid blocks. I mean, it doesn't take a geologist to realize this as you look at these temples. The erosion of these huge blocks is very, very pronounced. I mean, they look very, very old. And they look all much older than the pyramids. The other thing about these temples is that not only they use these large blocks, if one would say, well, they wanted to advertise how brave they were and how strong they were, but if so, then it doesn't make sense because they actually covered these blocks with a facing of granite blocks, of much smaller blocks, so you couldn't see these blocks anyway. Hmm. So, you know, the theory that they were wanted to impress us doesn't work.
Yeah, that's right.
So something... What has been the most logical explanation for the covering, by the way, of these blocks with the facing of granite blocks is that these temples pre-existed the pyramid builders and they were used later by the pyramid builders who found them there and actually covered them because the blocks, the inner blocks, the large blocks, were totally eroded. And you can see that when the cover is removed, the inside blocks are very eroded.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the most logical conclusion, that we're looking at a ancient, very ancient megalithic phase. Now, why did they use these blocks? Now, when we got to Jebel Uweinat, and I was there with Tom Brophy, we entered a valley called Karkur Tahl. Karkur Tahl is one of the most mysterious places in the world, where much of this rock art exists, by the way. And there, we were stunned, because the walls of the valley looked like they were made with giant blocks. In fact, they were natural blocks, but the geology was such that it's a trompe-l'œil, as we say in French. You could easily be fooled that they were actually constructed.
Hmm.
Now, if the ancient Egyptians of the pre-dynastic period or the early dynastic period actually went there and saw this, and clearly they must have been puzzled who put them there. They must have thought the gods did this. You know,
yes.
That's the first thing. It is not impossible that what they wanted to do later on is to actually build like the gods, if you like. And therefore, that's how the gods built. They were using these large blocks. What seems to confirm this is that when you travel in the Sahara, and especially not far from Abu Simbel, between Abu Simbel and the the Kharga Oasis, you will find that there are fields, literally fields, of pyramids. And they're not man-made, they're natural. But you will swear when you drive through these fields that these are pyramids. I mean, I've actually fooled a group of Egyptologists. I've taken a picture of one of these, and I put it, I'm serious. I put it on the internet and I said, we discovered the pyramid. And they all believed it.
Uh-huh.
Because it looks like a pyramid. I mean,
so how are these formed? How are they?
Well, they're formed by the natural erosion of wind. Is that when you have a hillock, eventually it will lose its covering, its softer covering, and as the wind blows, it will shape it into a pyramid shape. I mean, it's very strange, but that's what it does. You really have to be very, very close to these natural pyramids to realize that they're not man-made. But looking at them from a distance. Now, one can imagine those pharaohs before architecture wandering in the desert to meet their ancestors, you know, and happily going backwards and forwards, and finally deciding that they were going to build the same thing as their ancestral gods presumably did in the Sahara. Now, I'm not saying that this is the case, but it does certainly explain why suddenly architecture developed in these forms, and why suddenly, not suddenly, but why we have the megalithic temples at Giza with these strange large blocks. So it's not an impossible situation. It looks like, in my view, that the ancient Egyptians, the pharaonic historical Egyptians, knew their origins and believed that their origins were from the gods. They imagined that their ancestors had been linked to the gods, and that's how they lived. So when you went to the east, the Eastern Sahara, the Egyptian Sahara, and they traveled around there, they saw the land of the gods, if you like.
Yes.
And the land of the gods had pyramids and huge blocks and astronomy and alignments and all these things that they eventually inherited. So, in my view, the whole thing fits. There's a lot of work to do there, by the way, but I think we're on the right track.
So again, it's a reflection of the relationship to the surrounding environment and the natural. What you're saying, in a way, is that the roots of architecture is organic. They're natural features, and then we human beings replicate them later on. And it's a kind of a veneration to nature.
Absolutely. I mean, look. I mean, it's not just architecture. All human endeavor is finally traced back to nature. I mean, that's where we started. You know, astronomy.
Yes.
I mean, astronomy is nothing more than the observation of the stars and understanding their cycles. Geometry. Historians of mathematics are very convinced that the origins of geometry and everything that led to complex mathematics comes from the observation of the sky.
Yes.
You know, they align things, they measure things, and they drew them. You know, and so we owe everything to early man's observation of nature. But early man's observation of nature wasn't us who wanted to exploit nature. They merely observed it and revered it and duplicated it. So, you know, it's a very, very different perception than we have today. And but the strangest thing of all that we tend to forget is that we're the same human beings.
Yes.
We're no different from them. The only difference is that we have a different education. And we need to perhaps reconsider our education to take into account this way of looking at nature.
And I guess as well, then, that you mentioned a little bit in the first hour, this idea, or rather reason, why these people began looking at the stars. As that was a survival thing, so to speak. The stars maybe even became symbols of survival and later almost archetypal in our consciousness, because they were so closely linked to our own survival, meaning that it was through the stars that we could get life. Would you say that that's correct?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking, but the needs of people, even today, I mean, I can tell you that if you would get lost in the Sahara, the only way to survive would be to know how to find water and know where you're going.
Yes.
So you would be obliged. I mean, I can tell you, after a few days that you travel in the open desert, at night, for example, when you wander around, you are very much advised not to wander too far, because you easily get lost in this kind of environment. It sounds strange, but you take about 400 or 500 paces from the camp, and if there is no lights, you're lost.
Yeah.
So the only way you find your way back is to know the direction, and the direction is pinpointed by stars. So you're obliged. You will see, but quite naturally, that this is what you begin to learn. So all these conditions will form and mold the creatures, which is us, that needs to survive. Now, we happen to be an intelligent and conscious creature, and it's not surprising that at first we integrated to nature, but then, perhaps unfortunately, we began to break away from nature and forget that we got all this knowledge from nature itself.
Yes.
So I really think that this is an important lesson, because, you know, we simply need to re-establish this contact, this link, because without that link, we do not respect nature. We simply think it's something detached from us, that it that we don't need to connect to it. And it's a mistake, because everything we have, and the phone that I'm using now, it comes from nature.
That's right. Absolutely right. It's a good point. Everything... no matter how unnatural we think it is, or how recent or modern it is, it's still built of the elements in our environment and clothing surrounding. Yes, absolutely right.
Absolutely. And so, your other part of the question, which is about the stars and their, and our origins, is, well, the truth of the matter is that we are people that came from the stars. I mean, I don't mean that, you know, a flying saucer landed from a star and we stepped out.
Yeah.
But there's no question in the mind of cosmologists and astronomers and astrophysicists that the origins of our planetary system comes from an exploded star. Which star is another matter, but there's no question about it. And we are the mutated matter of that star come conscious. I mean, that's what we are. We're star stuff that is thinking. And therefore, you know, to sense this is perhaps one of the greatest mysteries, is that the knowledge of our origins may in fact be literally keyed in our genetic system, in our DNA. Mm-hmm. It's possible that we know our origins without knowing it. And therefore, it's not perhaps surprising that the people who did not have all the external stimuli that we have, but internalized their search for knowledge because they were obliged to do so, they didn't have the technology and the science that we have that pushes us to look outside rather than inside.
Yeah, that's right.
And they may indeed have been able to sense this origin, and hence their interest in their stellar origins. In other words, they arrived at the same conclusion that our cosmologists have arrived without science. And therefore, it raises another question, that perhaps we are focusing too much on trying to get the answers with science, because there are certain things that science cannot reach. And we have the ability to reach those things because we have the intuitive and imaginative faculties. And these are not so much used these days because of the way we live. So, you know, that perhaps is the way to look at all this.
Absolutely. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about climate change overall as well. If we go back into history first, I think that there, you mentioned that there was then something happened in the environment in this region as well back around 5,000 years ago. And do you know what that could have been? What was the reason for that?
Well, the reason is that our planet is not as stable as we think. And although we're talking about geological time, which is vast periods of time, we know that this planet has undergone huge, huge changes. Some of the changes were so drastic that it eliminated practically huge swathes of animal life, like the dinosaurs, for example. We've had tremendous floods, we've had meteoroid strikes, and so forth. But one of the things that does cause, now it's a very complex subject, and I don't want to go into the causes of climatic changes, but there are certain factors about the way that the Earth moves and spins that may be at the root of regular climatic changes.
Yes.
And when I say regular, I mean talking of thousands of years. Now we know that ice age come and go. We're due for one, by the way. We know that the last ice age was roughly at around 10,000, 12,000 BC. That's the period that we're talking about. And what happens when these big changes occur is that the climate is vastly affected. huge volumes of water are discharged by the melting ice. We have super storms, we have gigantic floods, and so forth. And what was happening in the Sahara was that, unlike what it is today, which is a bone dry, lifeless environment, it was very fertile. You know, and the evidence of the rock art shows us that it was fertile in human existence. I mean, humans were living very happily in the Sahara, while in the Nile Valley it was quite the opposite because of the drastic floods and swamps that existed there. It was not very hospitable. But then the reverse happened about 10,000 years ago. The floods, the climate began to calm. The floods began to be more or less dramatic. The Nile Valley became a beautiful paradise, while the Sahara became more and more dry. And so when these people were literally forced to step out of their own paradise because it became dry, they found another paradise in the Nile Valley. So this is... geologically and climatically, the root cause of civilization. I mean, the funny thing is that without those climatic changes, we probably would not have had civilization.
That's funny, isn't it? Yeah. Because do you think that if these changes were quick, the climatic changes were fairly quick, we should say, maybe this could explain a little bit as well many of the mysteries that surrounding why some civilizations or people or a culture is... which seems to be disappear, or they move quickly to another area. Do you think that that's the case here?
Well, yes, I think that there's a lot to look into. I don't know if you're getting me to talk about Atlantis, which I will not.
No, not really. We can talk about the, you know, people talk about the Mayans, for instance, that they
leave quickly. There are many factors that cause a culture to wane and perhaps even disappear. Mm. I mean, we know the causes of some. I mean, we know the cause of the total annihilation of the pharaonic civilization, for example. I mean, it was invaded by the Greeks and then by the Romans, and that was it. So these things are artificial causes, but there are natural causes as well. We know that these big climatic changes forced people out of their environment, and literally whole cultures were lost. Even civilization may have disappeared, which we haven't traced yet. You know, the world isn't, you know, the funny thing about all this, you know, as one gets into look at prehistory, is that there was a prehistory before the prehistory as well.
Yes.
You know, our planet has been here for 4.5 billion years. And the whole cosmological environment has existed for at least 20 billion years. You know, it's very funny when you think that the cosmos has existed for something like 16 to 17 billion years without our planetary system even there, let alone human beings.
Yes.
I mean, it's quite an incredible thing.
Indeed.
And then when you think of human beings appearing hardly a million or 2 million years ago and civilization springing about 6,000-7,000 years ago, you realize how short a period we've existed. I mean, you could flick the finger in the time frame and not even demonstrate how short a time human beings have been civilized on this universe.
Yes.
And therefore, we know very little about ourselves. I mean, the truth of the matter is that we hardly know anything about our own prehistory, let alone the prehistory of our planet. And there is no reason at all why there were cultures that might have developed and are totally annihilated or covered up by the geological changes. I'm not against that possibility.
Yes.
What I'm against, to be honest with you, is that people come up with unsubstantiated theories and get everybody confused. So there is a serious research being done here, and NAPTA Playa is one of them, mm-hmm. that will lead us to the origins of who we are and to understand better, you know, what we represent on this planet. But one needs to pursue it, with our feet firmly on the ground, because it's very easy to get lost in all sorts of theories, and the next thing you know, we're going to bring some people from some distant galaxy coming here and setting it all for us, which is doing ourselves a great disservice.
Mm-hmm.
Having said this, let me tell you something that will puzzle your readers and perhaps puzzle your listeners and puzzle my own readers, is that I am now invited to give a talk on television with my brother, by the way, who is also a researcher.
Mm-hmm.
And the topic is UFO or not UFO at Giza.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's been a huge commotion on the internet because of the title of the talk, and I have never myself speculated on that possibility.
Yeah.
However, having said this, I think that each one of us, however skeptical, must have an open mind that we do not know our distant past.
Absolutely, yeah.
And therefore, anything is possible. And, you know, I'm a great believer that if some super being would come and tell us really what it's all about, it would be even more bizarre than the most bizarre theories that we have. You know, we do exist in a very mysterious universe that is totally inexplicable. You know, we can hardly explain our planet, let alone this whole universe. And therefore, to have a closed mind to any possibility is a mistake.
Yes.
But I will quote a famous saying by Richard Dawkins, who the skeptic, who once said to, when he was accused of not having an open mind, he came up with an excellent phrase that said that he's ready to have an open mind, but he's not ready for his brains to drop out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the big difference between having an open mind and being asked to believe in anything. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, and you, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the difference as well is that there's no mistake or nothing wrong with thinking about the possibilities of different theories and entertain the ideas. But at the same time, it's a different thing if you just throw yourself in there and believe them without any kind of evidence. You know, there's a huge difference there, obviously.
Well, we always say lack of evidence is no proof of that something didn't exist.
Sure.
But it is also very important for any serious researcher, I believe, that there's nothing wrong at all in speculating and being open to all sorts of possibilities, because, I repeat, we do exist in a very mysterious environment beyond our planet. I mean, talk to any cosmologist and he will agree with you instantly. I mean, I can tell you that a cosmologist once told me that they've reached such a stage of looking at the cosmos that they call it crazy science, because it's totally beyond their comprehension.
Yeah.
And therefore, to claim that we understand and know how this universe functions and its purpose is a terrible mistake. So I think that any serious researcher should be open. He should be open when there is reasons to investigate.
Yes.
You know, I wrote a book, for example, called The Mars Mystery with Graham Hancock, where we looked at the possibility of artificial structures on Mars. And I can tell you that many, many scholars were very angry with us. And we said, well, be angry if you wish, but there was a possibility, even if it is one in a million possibility that there are artificial structures on Mars, then future generations will accuse us of being so biased that we couldn't even be bothered to check it. So it is, you know, one has to be not frightened to explore various avenues.
So tell us just a little bit about the Mars mysteries, briefly, if you can encapsulate that. What do you think that is? Did you and Graham find evidence that indeed that there are structures on Mars? And if so, what did you speculate were the origins of these were?
Well, let me explain why Graham and I got involved with this. In 1997, as you may recall, there was a big excitement because some scientists had discovered meteorites that contained fossilized microorganisms, and that the meteorites had come from Mars. So there was a huge excitement that the microorganism indicated that there might have been life on Mars. And this opened up, you know, an old sore in scientists that Mars may have been a living planet. There's no reason why it might not have been. I mean, let's put it this way.
Yes.
You know, we are the living proof that living planets exist.
That's right.
So we got interested, and one of the things that drew our attention at the time was that there was a big fuss about images that had been taken by the Voyager's probes that had gone to photograph Mars. And one of the areas that had been photographed, the so-called Cydonia area,
yes,
there were structures, one of them that was claimed to be a face, which frankly we were not very much taken by that, although mm-hmm. it did look like a face, I mean, mm-hmm. it must have been. And the other was a series of what looked like pyramid structures. And that was extremely intriguing. Some serious researcher had gotten to this. I'm talking about people like Mark Carlotto, and then to some degree Richard Holden, who yeah. did a lot of work on this.
Yes.
And in fact, I got to know Richard Holden and Mark Carlotto quite well. And, you know, I must admit that the way that they were exploring this was very convincing that there was something there that needed to be looked at.
Yes.
And therefore, Graham and I decided to have a look. And then the next thing we knew, we were getting very entangled with talking to astronomers and all the researchers involved. There's a gentleman called Chris O'Kane who lives in Glasgow, who was the equivalent of Richard Holden in England. And then we decided, well, why not? We're going to write a book. The approach that we must have is neither to take part in saying these are artificial or not artificial. What we'll do is we'll do the proper thing and look at the evidence and let the reader decide.
Yes.
You know, and that's
yes.
what we did.
Yes.
And I must say that, you know, at one stage, you know, you wake up one day and say, no, it's not possible. And you wake up the next day saying, well, it might be, you know. The thing is that recent photography has certainly convinced me. I know a lot of people are not yet convinced that, in fact, these structures are not artificial. I may be wrong, but that's how it looks to me.
Mm.
But I'm not sorry to have investigated, because this is what man must do. You know, if there is any chance at all that there has been life or intelligent life out there, then it would be absolutely foolish.
Let's continue then, talking a little bit more about the Mars mysteries. And again, to recap there, but you mentioned that pretty much the idea that if we do not consider there to be life out there in some way, that's pretty much foolish, right?
Well, I think that there is no astrophysicist or cosmologist today that will react the way that they were about 30, 40 years ago. You know, where if you mention the possibility of intelligent life or life at all outside our planetary system, they would laugh at you. It was not cool to discuss this. But the evidence is that there are many, many solar systems out there. I mean, we now find them virtually on a daily basis. And it is inconceivable that such a vast universal landscape with literally millions of galaxies and each of them with billions of stars would not have at least one that could sustain the same kind of conditions that our planet can.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, it's almost becoming a sort of arrogant position by those who resist that possibility. Nonetheless, it's a very different thing to suppose this and then to claim that people came down here with the machines and saucers and whatever. Now, it's not impossible, but the importance of the claim must be backed with important evidence. And
yes.
So far, the evidence has not been convincing. I mean, there are certain questions, there's no doubt about it, that are interesting to look at.
Yes. But Robert, are you saying a little bit that during the time when you and Graham were like investigating these potential structures on Mars, and that it seemed very promising, but subsequently after this, when more photographs have become available, etc., you're moving more towards the fact that these are probably natural structures?
That's correct. And, you know, one of the most important thing that must be in the forefront of any researcher, and that's why I have great respect for Graham Hancock, is that when you're wrong, you say you're wrong. You know, I mean, that's the quality of the researcher. And I can tell you that many, many academics have a lot of trouble saying they're wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I have a problem with Egyptologists on that, I can tell you. But the fact is that the evidence in the early 70s and even early 90s was very convincing. But we were talking about photographs taken from 1,000 kilometers with very low resolution and so forth. You know, now every tourist, I live in the Costa del Sol, by the way, so I'm looking at the tourists on the beach at the moment. You know, they all carry cameras that have 10 to 12 million pixels these days. When the Mars photographs were taken, they were using 1.5 million pixels. So, you know, things have changed.
Yes.
And the resolution shows us that these structures are very unlikely to be artificial. You know, that's what is coming out. Still, there is, I must say, a faint thread of possibility if those who believe in it would carry on. I know Richard Hoagland hasn't given up yet. There are many other things like that. I mean, we don't have to go all the way to Mars to be surprised at things that exist on our planet. I mean, we haven't yet explained, for example, certain prehistoric sites.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right. So, and again, the mystery of how they moved some of these stones. We have the...
Exactly.
The unfinished obelisk in the quarry of Aswan. We have a Baalbek, incredible site just here on Earth that seems to suggest that something mysterious and strange has been going on, you know, because we don't comprehend it, how they did it today, you know?
Well, let me put it in slightly different words.
Mm-hmm.
It seems mysterious and strange in most cases because we are trying to fit them into a context that has been given to us by the scholars, and that context may be wrong.
Yes.
I mean, for example, we're even thinking that there may be errors in climatic models. This business of the Sahara is being looked at very carefully because according to the climatologists, they have created models that don't seem to fit the evidence that we have. You know, we think that the Sahara had probably much more water than the climatologists believe, probably even in the time of the pharaohs. So, you know, these things, you know, one has to be very, very careful with science, especially when it comes to that kind of science. You know, when you look, you see the very scant evidence upon which whole consensuses are built. For example, I mean, one of the grave errors that was done, coming back to the research I know of the Sahara, is that until 2007, what mm-hmm. am I saying, 2007,
mm-hmm. right.
Egyptologists were absolutely convinced, and anthropologists, that the ancient Egyptians had not traveled into the deep Sahara. I mean, that was a fact as far as they were concerned. Well, that fact is no more a fact. We've proved it beyond any doubt that they went all the way to Jebel Uweinat, 700 kilometers into the deep Sahara.
Yes.
And let me tell you, as I was telling you earlier, today, if you want to do this trip, you'll have to really prepare very carefully, and you'll need to travel for 5 to 6 days with a four-wheel drive to reach that place.
Yes.
It's no mean task.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, it's quite possible that we know the Egyptologists had it wrong, but it's quite possible that even the scientists, the climatologists, had it wrong. And maybe the climate was very different. So, you know, I'm very, very skeptical when I read things as being established. You know, science, especially science of the past, is something that changes all the time.
Yes.
You know, we started hardly 150 years ago with people believing that the Earth was created in 4000 BC by the hand of God, you know.
Yeah.
We're now in a totally different scientific perspective. And it may well be that in a few centuries time, what seems impossible to us today may be very possible for our future scholars.
I believe
that, you know, we really must have a very open mind, but we need to behave as serious researcher and build whatever ideas we have on evidence that can be demonstrated so that we don't confuse the public. And I'm a great believer in that. I've always been that. And therefore, I'm very often accused by some of my colleagues to not have an open mind. Well, I do have an open mind, but I'm not going to throw my brains out.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think that our scientific models will improve the technology we use to find out things about the past and so forth. But when physical evidence is, you know, eroded away, so to speak, long gone, do you think it's okay or fair of us to kind of go to the mythological record to look for so-called evidence? Do you consider that to be okay, so to speak?
Of course. I mean, you know, we have to go to whatever evidence, or at least whatever information there is, and try and weigh it whether it is mythical or not.
Yes.
I mean, the ancient Egyptians are, I mean, you know, really bent backwards in their texts to tell us that they have very ancient origins. You know, they keep saying this in their texts.
Yes.
And Egyptologists keep saying, no, this is a lot of hocus pocus. Well, here we go. I mean, it looked like they not only knew of their origins, they actually went to meet their ancestors, you know. So that's a very good title for the book, by the way, Meet the Ancestors. There you are. I mean, these are things that, you know, the kind of attitude that scholarship has taken, especially in the field of Egyptology,
yes,
is, in my view, very limited. You know, there is something very wrong about insisting on what they now say is tangible evidence. Tangible evidence, of course, is welcome because it is something that you can touch and measure and so forth. But now we're using the term non-tangible evidence. For example, astronomy. The astronomy of Nabta Playa is non-tangible. I mean, you can't actually touch it, you know, but,
yeah,
but it does prove what physical evidence cannot do. So, you know, we really need to change that mentality of Egyptologists that have become so much driven with their archaeological evidence that they refuse to consider anything else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, what is myth after all? I mean, you could even say that the Bible is myth and the Gospels. So we need to be very careful about this kind of branding, and we really need to be open to ancient narratives that could be rooted in historical facts. I'm not against that at all.
No, and I guess the trick here as well, and the dilemma in a way that you're describing, is this idea that on one hand, science is very orthodox, almost backwards in the way that they don't take in new information, and at the same time, on the other side of the camp, you have people who are maybe too extreme and incorporate too much in their belief system right away, instead of just looking at some of the evidence, right? So it's a problem here to keep yourself balanced in a way to paint a proper picture.
Sorry to interrupt, but yes, you're absolutely right. You need to be somewhere in between. I mean,
yes,
extreme skepticism is unhealthy, and extreme speculation is also unhealthy. I mean, one needs to stay and sail this research ship in a very proper and manner that allows speculation on the one hand and allows rigidity of evidence on the other. But
yes,
to be extreme is not good. However, let me just use an example. I mean, I was born in Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
If you had told me, I'm 61 years old, so if you had told me when I was a child that I could pick up a little thing that you could put in your hand and call somebody in Alaska and see his image, I would have laughed.
Yeah.
You know, and every Tom, Dick, and Harry and everybody in the street does this nowadays.
Yeah.
So, you know, what seems to us impossible today is not necessarily impossible. It's simply impossible because we don't have the explanations for it. But having said that, I was born in Alexandria. You know, when I go there, I know for a fact that my house doesn't exist there anymore. It's been knocked down and they built a block of flats on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that I even talk to people who live in the streets, and when I tell them that there was a house there, they don't believe me.
You know? So, I see what you mean, yeah, yeah.
So there you are. I mean, you know, and I'm only talking about my own lifetime.
Yeah.
So we're talking about 10, 20,000 years ago, if not more.
Yes.
And one has to be very, very cautious about making claims that Egyptologists have been claiming, saying there was no such culture. Well, they'll have to eat their hats on this one because there was a culture.
You know? Well, yes, yes. So what is maybe in the last couple of minutes here that we have, Robert, is there anything else that you think we've missed out in regards to your new book, Black Genesis? If there's something more you'd like to mention that you go into in the book that we haven't talked about?
Indeed. And one of the items that I purposely did not mention is because I didn't want to complicate our discussion. But one of the sites that was discovered by Carlo Bergman, I mentioned Carlo Bergman, who found the Abu Balas Trail, if you remember.
Yes.
Carlo Bergman discovered a large mound to the south of the oasis of Dakhla. And that surprised Egyptologists even more, because that mound contained not just rock art, but had pharaonic inscriptions. And the name of the most dramatic pharaoh appears on it, the name of Cheops, and his son Djedefra.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, opens a huge Pandora box here, because the mound that on which this inscription exists, it's actually called Djedefra. He actually named it Djedefra Water Mountain. You can Google it, and there's a lot of information on it.
Mm.
I actually went to see this with Tom Brophy. And what we noticed immediately that was not noticed by Carlo Bergman and the anthropologists, because they weren't looking for it, is that there are solar alignments. And this is very, very interesting, because we know that Khufu, and particularly Djedefra, the son of King Cheops, was the first to incorporate solar names and solar alignments in his pyramid sites. And this is, to me, at least a very strong evidence that he learned it from people who were there in the Sahara. I'm very convinced that we have now a link that puts these two cultures, one prehistoric and one historic, in contact with each other, and there was a huge cultural exchange. And one of the things that was passed over was this knowledge of astronomy. It's very early days. I don't want to go too much into that because we're still studying, but that's what I would like your listeners to bear in mind, because the story of the Sahara hasn't yet begun.
Yes.
And we at least are beginning it with our book.
Okay, very interesting, Robert. Thank you again very much for coming on. The website is robertbouval.co.uk, and as you mentioned, you expect the book to be out in towards the end of summer 2010, then, I guess. And will people be able to get the book through your website at that point?
Oh, I hope they'll be able to get into the bookshops.
In the bookshops, yeah, okay, gotcha. And
I think some of my books are in Swedish. I know one.
I'm not sure about that either, actually. I've only read the some of the English versions. So
there is an Orion mystery version in Sweden.
There
Swedish.
Is, huh? Okay, there you go. Okay, excellent.
Somewhere there.
Yes. Okay, well.
Okay, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure, Hendrik. And when the time comes, when the book is published, perhaps we'll give you another interview.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Robert.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye.
That's our program with Robert Bouval, and we held off on the topic of the book Talisman for this time. There's just too much to discuss there, and it deserves a program on its own. So we'll invite Robert back to the program to talk about this huge subject later. Joseph P. Farrell, MEP Martha Andreasen, Anthony and Derek from We Are Change Ireland, Kathleen Meckerlane, and Aaron Kaplan will join us on the program soon. Some familiar and some new names there. Go to our website and check out the guest links if you want to find out more about them. In the area of webcasts, we are planning and will be doing programs with Daniel Tapman, Court Lindahl, Ben Singleton, and Michael Tesserion. Okay, my friends, let's round things up here for this time. I want to say thank you again for joining us in our member section and for subscribing. I also want to extend my thanks to Fredrik, Elisabeth, and Marie. So take care, go easy, and we will talk more soon.